Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
In August of 2010, a poll conducted by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life found that 18% of American citizens considered President Barack Obama to be a Muslim. This figure was up from 11% when the question was asked in March of 2008. A similar question in a survey conducted by Time magazine in August 2010 claimed that 24% of Americans thought the president adhered to Islam as his personal faith. Interestingly, the poll taken by the Pew Forum also saw a significant increase in the number of people who did not know what President Obama's personal faith was, from 34% answering this way in March of 2008 to 43% this past August. Given that Barack Obama has been president for a year and a half, in the national spotlight for 2.5 years, and given that he has publicly affirmed his allegiance to Christianity, this increase is all the more surprising. These poll results, combined with a recent controversy over the sighting of a mosque or Muslim cultural center a few blocks away from where the World Trade Center had stood, has reinserted the topic of religion into the national political scene during a crucial midterm election cycle, where it appeared that economic issues would dominate the debate. But as any historian or political scientist who has examined U.S. elections will tell you, religion is ever present in the good times and in the bad. To discuss the role that religion plays in national elections, and to offer some thoughts on religion in the current election cycle, I am joined today by Corwin Schmidt, director of the Paul B. Henry Institute for the Study of Christianity and Politics, and professor of political science at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Professor Schmidt is author and co-author of numerous books, including Pews, Prayers and Participation, Religion and Civic Responsibility in America, and most recently, The Disappearing God Gap, Religion in the 2008 Presidential Election. And as director of the Henry Institute, Professor Schmidt runs a biannual symposium for scholars on religion and politics and an annual workshop for graduate students interested in survey research and the study of religion and politics. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about those programs at the end of the podcast. Corwin, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. I'm glad to be here.
Great. Well, I want to spend most of our time today talking about the contemporary political scene, which I defined roughly from our last presidential election in 2008 up to present time. And given the contemporary nature of our discussion, I should note to our listeners that we are recording this podcast on August 30th of 2010, and we will likely be posting it in mid-October, a few weeks before what appears to be a fiercely competitive midterm election. So if anything big occurs between now, which is late August and October, such as the rapture, I don't know, we won't hold you, Professor Schmidt, personally responsible for any of that.
All right, good.
All right. So let's, before we get into the 2000 presidential election and the upcoming midterms, let's talk about a few generalities about religion and national elections. My first question is, has there ever been a presidential election that has not been influenced in some way or another by religion or religious factors?
Well, I can't say if there's never been one, but certainly in many there have been instances in which religion comes into play, and I would say it's much more the norm than the exception in terms of just the general discussion and sort of the contours of the election itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose, you know, in our book, we do talk about different ways in which religion can come into play. We give some historical examples from different elections in which sometimes religion comes into play because a candidate kind of represents an outside religious group. And so you can sort of think of, say, the 1960 election in which JFK was running as a Catholic, and mm-hmm. obviously 1928 when Al Smith also ran as a Catholic, where there was discussion about, well, to what extent should the office of the presidency be extended to this kind of religious group, if you want to look at it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other times in which the moral character of candidates come into play. Grover Cleveland and his election. He had fathered an illegitimate child, and there was a lot of discussion about to what extent such kind of a person should represent the country. And then more recently, we see elections in which religion is used as a means by which to mobilize voters and get them to the polls. So there's a variety of ways in which religion can come into play in presidential elections,
mm-hmm.
and religious groups frequently link themselves to different political parties and different candidates, and so in that sense, religion also comes into play in presidential elections.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I pulled from your book, and I think our listeners will find very interesting, is just the depth to what religion has, to what religion has played throughout presidential campaigns throughout history. I mean, we think of, well, the religious right is where voter mobilization occurs, but I mean, you could go back to the Prohibition era and many eras of the Progressive era and see that as well.
Abolitionists, I mean, they had a lot of religious roots, too, in terms of their political engagement. And certainly, if you want to go way back, I suppose the first election in which religion really came into play was the election of 1800, when Jefferson was running against Adams, and there were questions about Jefferson's religious sincerity or orthodoxy, I guess you could say.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting questions that always comes up, and you bring this out as the issue of religious outsiders or sign of moral character, I guess, is the issue of a president having some degree of religiosity and having that publicly known. To what extent has that changed over the past 200 years or so? I mean, we saw that, as you mentioned, the 1928 election, Al Smith, a Catholic, was running against Herbert Hoover, and you know, the fact that Al Smith was a Catholic became a big, huge issue. But by 1960, you know, yeah, it mattered in the Kennedy race, but Kennedy overcame it.
Right. Well, I do think as our country becomes more pluralistic in terms of religious characteristics, that what is considered an outside group changes over time.
Mm-hmm.
So at one time, when we were a heavily Protestant country, Catholics were an outgroup. Today, when we think about Christianity more generally versus other religions such as Islam, Catholics very easily fall into sort of the inside group as opposed to an outside group that Muslims might be perceived today.
Mm-hmm.
And so Americans have always, well, I can't say always in the sense I don't have survey data going all the way back into the 1800s, but since we've had survey data and we can sort of assess American public opinion, Americans have consistently said that they want their president to be religious.
Mm-hmm.
Even as late as 2008, 75% of Americans say they want their president to be religious. But it does make some difference as to what kind of religion that is. Not all religions are treated equally in terms of wanting their president to be religious.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting issues that you cite on page 35 of your most recent book, The Disappearing God Gap, is the question about the willingness to support a presidential candidate by candidate's religious affiliation. Now, we talked about this issue of, you know, whether President Obama is a Muslim and looked at the survey data there. And the survey data that you cite here says that 45% of Americans are less likely to support a Muslim presidential candidate. 3% would be more likely, which is a gap of about 42%. But there is one category that is actually even higher than that of Muslims. And what is that?
That's atheists. Americans are much more likely to say they would vote for a Muslim than they would to vote for an atheist. And that's been true prior to 9/11, and it's also true now after 9/11.
Mm-hmm. And it's remarkable, just to look at the data here for folks listening, is that 61% of the respondents in the survey said they were less likely to support an atheist, 3% more likely, and that was a gap of 58%. And compared to that, what we just mentioned for Muslims, the gap was 42%. So that's a big, significant increase. What were some of the other categories that are on there that are considered religious outsiders?
Well, certainly Mormons, and that also came into play in the 2008 election with the candidacy of Mitt Romney.
Right.
And then you can look at Jews and Catholics and evangelical Christians. Those categories tend to be more neutral. There are some people who say they're more likely to vote for an even for a presidential candidate if they're such a person were an evangelical Christian.
Mm-hmm.
But almost a similar level would say they're less likely to vote for such a person if they knew they were an evangelical Christian. So it kind of washes out for the other groups, although even for these more inside, quote, inside groups, there are those who are more prone or less prone to vote for a candidate if they know that they're of this particular religious persuasion.
Mm-hmm. Now, that survey is largely geared toward national presidential candidates. One of the things that is interesting to me, and maybe you have some thoughts on this, is that as you move down from federal elections, especially from the president, then you move down to senatorial elections, congressional representatives, then move into the state gubernatorial elections or elections for state legislature, then all the way down to the municipal level, religion seems to become less important. I mean, that's my general sense of things. It just might be that I'm sitting out here in the Puget Sound, which is basically a religious wasteland. But I mean, is that a tendency that when you move down toward municipal elections, religion plays less of a role?
I think it's overall probably a true assertion. I think part of that may be that there is less differences religiously as you move down towards local communities. Now, obviously, if you're talking about New York or Seattle, I mean, that's a little different than if you're talking about, say, Holland, Michigan, or some Benton Harbor, Michigan, or something to that effect, where you're talking about a town maybe of 30 to 50,000 or even smaller, in which there's much less religious differences, both for historic and also for ethnic reasons, I guess you could say. So I think overall that tends to be the case, although even in Grand Rapids, a town of a city of about 250,000, although we have a fair number of suburbs that surround it, historically, there was a big difference between the Dutch who settled here who were Protestants and the Polish who settled here who were Catholics. And so there were some differences there religiously as well in terms of which party they aligned with and the candidates they advanced and so forth. But some of that, I think, has dissipated over time.
I mean, I guess for me it just seems that local elections tend to be more bread and butter issues of who's going to fix my, you know, potholes in front of my street, and religion doesn't factor into that as much. Whereas at a national level, you're dealing with a lot of very important economic issues, but they're much more amorphous. That it's difficult to know what, you know, policy X is going to have an effect on me, and so therefore we're looking for, you know, signals of a person's trustworthiness or credibility. You think that plays into it at all?
Yeah, I do, and but I would say at least in terms of some state legislative races, then you began to see some of this more religious involvement in these campaigns. I don't know, you know, perhaps it also relates to the form of government that local governments have, and some are more nonpartisan election kinds of governments, and so there's a, you know, it may also be related to the different kinds of systems of candidate selection that are involved at the more local level.
That sounds like an interesting research topic for any graduate student out there searching for a dissertation topic.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Let's spring back up to national, to federal elections once again. And I want to ask you about the title of your latest book. It is called The Disappearing God Gap. And I should note that there is a question mark after this, implying that the God gap may or may not have disappeared. So for those of folks who are not in the field of religion and politics per se here, what is the God gap?
Well, the God gap was a label that got sort of coined in the aftermath of the 2004 election. And one of the things, presidential election, and one of the things that was evident in the aftermath of that election was that the more religious, and typically this was measured in terms of church attendance, the more frequently you went to church, the less likely you were to vote Democratic. And there was some questions related to, well, is the Democratic Party, which historically had been a party that attracted the votes of many religious citizens, whether the Democratic Party was becoming in some ways, quote, a more secular party, a party composed primarily of supporters who kind of favored less religious involvement in public life, while the Republican Party was becoming, quote, the religious party.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some concerns about, well, is this something different than was true in previous years in American politics? And if American people are so religious overall compared to other countries, which I'll just have to assert here, I can't demonstrate that, but
mm-hmm.
American people are, by comparison, a highly religious people when compared at least to Western Europeans.
Right.
And then the question is, well, if Americans are so religious, what's the future of the Democratic Party in that kind of context?
Mm-hmm.
So what prompted the book was that in the 2008 election, there was much less talk during the campaign, and more particularly in the aftermath of Obama's victory, as to whether or not there was still a God gap or whether Obama had basically crushed the God gap.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that had changed dramatically between 2004 and 2008 was that, number one, the Democratic Party already in 2006 started to cultivate better relations with different religious groups. They had outreach campaigns to religious voters. And then the three primary Democratic candidates, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards, all had religious outreach staffers in their campaign organizations, which was totally different than what John Kerry had attempted in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
So there were some important changes that took place in terms of the Democratic Party organization and campaign organizations. And the question then was, well, has this effort then basically erased what was noted to be a God gap in the 2004 election?
Yeah, I know that Amy Sullivan, I believe, had a book talking about the Democrats closing this God gap. And so it obviously was on the mind of many Democrats throughout the past 4, 5, 6 years now of how to deal with this. One of the other things I want to kind of step back historically about, too, in relation to this God gap, is when I was in graduate school, this was my understanding of the God gap tended to be that it was denominationally based, that Catholics always tend to vote for Democrats, and, if you were a Presbyterian, well, that was the, Republican meeting place on Sundays, I guess. Has that changed over time? Whether do we still see this God gap in terms of denominational affiliation, or as you mentioned, it tends to be a religious attendance factor here?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I use the word God gap a little more narrowly because what I think was the previous pattern was, yes, there were religious differences in voting. There were highly religious people, Catholics, let's say, who voted Democratic. There were highly religious people, let's say, Presbyterians, who typically voted Republican.
Mm-hmm.
But what that meant was that both political parties had religious coalitions that were highly religious in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so there wasn't a religious secular divide between the two parties.
Mm-hmm.
What the church attendance God gap notion says is that the way in which religion shapes voting decisions is changing. It's changing from religious affiliation or belonging to religious behavior or religious beliefs, in terms of I believe in more traditional notions of religion, or I engage in more traditional religious behaviors. So if you look at the book and our data, what it suggests is that there are still very important differences in voting behavior between different religious groups.
Mm-hmm.
Evangelical Protestants vote differently than Black Protestants or than mainline Protestants or Roman Catholics. But there's also, within that sort of group division. There's also a division based upon what we call traditionalist versus modernist.
Mm-hmm.
So that a traditionalist evangelical, in terms of the way such a person votes, is actually closer to a traditionalist Catholic in many ways, and how that traditionalist Catholic votes, than a traditionalist evangelical is to what we call a modernist evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two kinds of religious divides that are occurring. And the real question is one replacing the other, or will they kind of continue this way over the next several elections? And depending upon what happens, it has important implications for how parties want to try to reach out to religious voters.
Mm-hmm. How do some of those cleavages break down in terms of modernist versus more traditionalist? And what are some of the big issues that are salient to some of these groups, like the traditionalist or versus the modernist?
Yeah.
And how do those separate?
Well, the way we define, you need to recognize that surveys have limited number of questions, and you try to include in a questionnaire some questions, a few, that might sort of tap these differences and sort of enable you to differentiate between the two. So, for example, we would label a traditionalist, for better or worse, someone who rejects the notion that all great religions are equally true and good, whereas a modernist would be much more accepting that it doesn't matter if you're a Christian or a Muslim, great religions all have sort of true components to them and probably are equally good in terms of paths to salvation.
Mm-hmm.
We also include some things like belief in evolution, although that it's much certainly a much more traditionalist perspective, though there are many people who would be very orthodox Christians who still might subscribe to notions of evolution in terms of a pattern of creation. So it's a what we would call a continuum, but we do have to make some dividing points, and we put some people in a more traditionalist category based upon their patterns of behavior and religious beliefs, and we put other people in what we labeled to be a more modernist category based on those same beliefs and behaviors. So I don't know if that was sufficient to explain the difference, but I can go into greater detail if you would like.
I mean, one of the questions I have is how this plays out into various issues that voters tend to be concerned about. Now, I think most of our listeners probably expect that, you know, traditionalists are going to be very skeptical of calls for gay marriage or more likely to support anti-abortion measures for candidates and such. I take that's the case. But what about economic issues? I mean, we're entering this bread and butter campaign.
Sure.
Of,
well, right now, you know, surprisingly, I guess I would call it surprisingly, this does have impacts also on economic issues and other issues like the environment and so forth. The real question is, how is it that these more traditionalist beliefs would have some kind of impact on whether or not you think we should reduce taxes or increase governmental spending? And I guess the way in which I've come to understand it is that over time, parties like the Republican Party, which perhaps attracted more traditionalist voters initially because of their stands on abortion, or let's say, at least for many of their candidates, stands on, say, homosexuality and gay marriage, that over time they began to link those kinds of social stands with the kinds of economic policies which those types of candidates were also advocating.
Mm-hmm.
And so while it's hard to see how these traditionalist religious beliefs would necessarily lead to particular economic stands, I think it's a function of sort of historical experience with regard to the types of economic stands candidates have articulated when they have been in alignment with them on these social issues.
Mm-hmm. Let me take us now we've got some background here. Let's take us into your book, The Disappearing God Gap, and you co-authored this with five other scholars as well. So a lot of different insights are coming into this book, and we're going to link to it on our website. It's a great read because not only is it filled with a lot of the statistics that scholars like to hear about, but it really plays through the 2000 election in a wonderful narrative storyline that it's really interesting to follow. And I think let's go ahead and follow that right now and ask that question, is the God gap disappearing? Let's start with the primaries first. And how did religion manifest itself in the presidential primaries in 2008?
Well, there were various ways in which it did so. Certainly, to begin with, as I talked about earlier, there were efforts to do direct outreach to religious voters. And that was true starting with Obama in Iowa and trying to link his campaigns with different churches and church groups in terms of meeting with them, that type of thing. There was certainly then Huckabee coming into Iowa and linking his campaign to a large number of homeschoolers. There's a network of homeschoolers that he seemed to have been able to tap that generated a fair amount of support for his candidacy in Iowa, and that obviously propelled him into greater prominence in the Republican portion of the campaign. You had different kinds of events. The Democrats hosted a number of faith forums during the years in which, both in 2007, but then in 2008 also, Democratic candidates were asked directly about their religious faith and how they understood it and how it might affect their politics. And there was one in April, just prior to the Pennsylvania primary, that was held at Messiah College. There were a number of other things. Obviously, Jeremiah Wright mm-hmm. and Obama's association with the church in Chicago. Throughout the campaign, there were different times in which religion came into play, and certainly Romney's Mormonism is another example. So it was on both in both political parties. It was quite sustained over the course of the primary season. And one final thing I would mention in light of some of the comments you mentioned earlier is that Obama's campaign literature, at least in many states, I can't say necessarily in every state, but in many states, it basically put committed Christian right on the literature in bold letters, perhaps as a way to demonstrate that he was not a Muslim. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain all the motivations for doing this, but certainly it may have been an attempt, and particularly in the southern states, in the South Carolina primary, to try to link himself to an electorate that was quite religious itself.
Yeah, you do have a picture of this on page 91 of the book. I'm taking a look at this now, and it does have a little map of South Carolina. And again, as you say, very bold lettering. Says committed Christian across it. Says called to bring change, called to serve, committed Christian, and talks about the power of prayer in this mailer that was sent out to a number of people. So obviously, yeah, very, very sensitive to these issues about religion at the time. You mentioned something about how Barack Obama used churches in the Iowa primary, and I think when we think back to 2008, right around the time of the Iowa primaries, most pundits were betting on Hillary Clinton coming through there fairly well, and Barack Obama was somewhat of a surprise. Was the fact that he was able to mobilize a lot of these faith communities one of the reasons why he was able to pull this, I guess, seemingly upset in Iowa?
I would say so, although it's hard to really assess just how much of a cushion that provided, but every little bit helped. Mm-hmm. And certainly... Barack Obama was from a neighboring state. Iowa has, given its caucus system, has a different kind of way of operating, and it's much more prone to certain kinds of upsets, I think, than presidential primaries, given the way it operates. I'm sure it helped, whatever help it provided helped to provide some cushion in terms of Barack Obama outpolling Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. I I can't say that that's what really made the difference. It's hard. That's harder to assess. Yeah. But certainly, we can observe that Obama had a religious strategy, that he was comfortable going into churches and campaigning, that he saw this as a means of mobilizing voters, and to some extent, he has to be assessed as being successful in mm-hmm. accomplishing that.
It does seem that the caucus system tends to lend itself more to religious mobilization, as in that, you know, churches are very good at bringing people to the pews every Sunday, and in a caucus system, what you actually have to do, instead of having people fill out a ballot in a polling place or increasingly through mail-in ballots, is you got to bring people to
right.
a meeting place. And churches are pretty good with that. I mean, how about the GOP side of the equation here in the primaries? There was some tension that would develop during this time between Mike Huckabee and Mitt Romney about Mitt Romney's Mormonism, and Huckabee was accused of anti-Mormon remarks at various points during the primary system. How did this play out?
Well, I think the context is that for many evangelical Christians, and maybe other Christians too, but particularly so among evangelical Christians, there is a real question as to what extent Mormonism is a true reflection of the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so Huckabee, who saw himself as an evangelical Christian, got himself caught up in some of this debate, which probably wasn't necessarily all that helpful in the long run, but perhaps was an effort to try to mobilize some evangelical voters in the short run.
Mm-hmm. And in terms, I know Romney came out and addressed this issue in a speech. I'm forgetting exactly where it was made, but you know, that actually, I listened to that speech, and that was a pretty well done speech, I think. And, you know, he basically tried to take this issue of his Mormonism off the table. And, you know, obviously, he didn't win the primary, so we could look back and say, well, I guess that wasn't successful on that, but, you know, his loss might have been for many other reasons. Do you think that speech has had any impact on how Mormons are perceived in the national political spotlight nowadays?
Well, the speech, if I remember correctly, was given at the Bush Presidential Museum, or at Texas A&M, where the first Bush Presidential Museum is located. And I think it was a good speech. I don't know that in the short run it had that much impact on many Republican voters, but I think and obviously the comparisons are always to the sort of the Houston speech that Kennedy had to, not had to, but delivered in the 1960 campaign, and how that was seen to, or at least perceived to, have diffused the Catholicism issue to some extent. I don't think it may be because it was a presidential primary and not the presidential election. That Romney speech didn't seem to have the same effect. There is, however, and I'm looking forward to the 2012 campaign, there has been some discussion about the different cultures between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and how the Democratic Party wants to go with people who are successful, and once you've lost, you're basically out. Whereas the Republican Party seems to reward people who are more tenacious is too strong a word, but persistent, mm-hmm. let's put it that way. You have to earn your dues. And so, you know, Reagan, who lost in 76, prevails in 1980. And there's sort of a different perception of you after having gone through the trials and tribulations and then coming back in the Republican Party. And I think Romney is actually, even for many evangelicals who perhaps were very opposed to him in the 2008 election, may be somewhat less inclined to oppose him simply on the basis of his Mormonism in the 2012 presidential primary process.
Now, you've kind of paid your dues. I mean, this is true of George H.W. Bush and Bob Dole and even John McCain, mm-hmm. who were talk about here in a second. One last thing on the primary season in 2008. We saw the emergence of the Jeremiah Wright issue for Obama, and also a statement he made at a fundraiser in San Francisco, I believe, about bitter clingers, or that, you know, the folks out in the rural areas right. will tend to cling to their guns and Bibles when times get bad. How did these issues get injected into the campaign, and how did they play out?
Well, part of the way they got injected is that we have a totally different kind of electronic world, and some of these things were available on YouTube, and there were pictures of these types of things, recordings done years ago that could be accessed and brought into the campaign. And I'm sure that they were noted in part because they brought controversy, differences of opinion, and for some it was perhaps newsworthy in and of itself that Obama went to this kind of church. Perhaps for others it was an attempt to discredit him both religiously and thereby politically.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't remember who really broke the story on the Jeremiah Wright situation, but it certainly propelled into prominence, and it came twice. If you recall, there was an earlier episode, and then it seemed to have died down, and then all of a sudden there was something new, and then Barack Obama was compelled to respond. He basically resigned his membership from the church, and then he gave a talk on race and American politics that, I don't know if it was because it was on race and not religion, but it seemed to have been overall very well received by many journalists and pundits, and he seemed to, in that sense, have benefited, actually, in some ways, from the Jeremiah Wright situation.
Yeah, I remember that speech as well, you know, much the way I mentioned I remember Romney's speech. And I think his speech, and as you were mentioning before, you know, Romney's speech came early in the primaries to deal with this, and everybody forgets about it. But, you know, Obama's speech really comes much later and really helps to define the campaign and his candidacy in that regard. I think that was a very important speech in that regard. So let's talk about after the dust of the primary settles here. And at the time in 2008, people were asking me about this. You study religion and politics and stuff. And I was thinking that religion was going to play less of a role in this presidential election than it had in previous elections, in part, especially as you get into late summer when, the economic situation is taking a front seat to everything here. And then also in part, and this is interesting, because of John McCain's perception as a religious individual or lack thereof. In fact, I remember being on a radio show at one point in time, and the host asked me, oh, so, you know, all this issue about religion is coming up. What's John McCain's denominational affiliation? And I had no idea, which was somewhat interesting. And McCain didn't seem to want to go and make a lot of hay out of the Jeremiah Wright controversy. So things, I mean, my reading of the 2008 general election seemed to be that the religious issue dies down. What's your take on this?
Well, I think to a certain extent that is true. Well, certainly a couple things that happened prior to the sort of the economic collapse. I mean, certainly jobs were important, but in the summer months leading up to the convention, there was some concern on the part of McCain. He just feels uncomfortable talking about religion. And so he I think, really did want it to kind of go away. He didn't want that to be a stumbling block for him. Now, there may be a couple reasons for that, but certainly, he wanted to mobilize his base. He needed to reassure his base, largely evangelical Christians and so forth, that he was kind of acceptable. But at the same time, he didn't want to sort of bow down to them in one way, so as to basically have other people who he was trying to attract their votes think that he was beholden to them.
Right.
That was kind of McCain's, in one sense, situation. However, interestingly, and I don't know, I can't say whether this was because of the lack of money on his campaign organization, because he went with public funding, if you remember, and so he had a very limited amount of money he could spend. He organized his staff not on the basis of sort of trying to reach out to religious constituencies, but to reach out to what he labeled to be social conservatives. And in some ways, that's a much more amorphous group. It overlaps, perhaps, with some religious groups, but it's, I would say it's much harder to mobilize social conservatives than it might be to mobilize people who are, in particular, pews of different kinds of churches.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I'm probably going off on a different tangent here a little bit, but I do think that if you look at the summer months, there was certainly some discussion of religion on the part of Obama's part. He had a consultation of different religious leaders in Chicago in June. Then we saw the Democratic Convention, in which there was a big religious celebration prior to the start of the Democratic Convention on Sunday night in Denver. You saw the Saddleback Forum, in which both John McCain and Barack Obama both appeared together. So there was certainly some of this religious element in the campaign during the summer months, late summer months, but perhaps certainly not to the same extent that we saw it during the primary process itself.
Mm-hmm. The only other point in the general election where I think religion is injected in a different way might have been with the selection of Sarah Palin as McCain's running mate, given that she had an affiliation with a Pentecostal church. What did that have any effect at all in this election?
Right. Well, it probably had the intended effect, at least initially. There was this issue of to what extent could Obama, given his reticence to talk about religion, his religious faith, to what extent could he energize the evangelical base of the Republican Party? And certainly Sarah Palin, the announcement of Sarah Palin and the initial days after the convention suggested that indeed it had its intended effect. The evangelicals, many evangelicals, were quite ecstatic about her nomination at that point. And in fact, you know, the Democrats held their convention before the Republicans in 2008, and following the Republican convention, John McCain actually led Barack Obama in national polls for the first week in September. But then when we had the big market crash, then basically the discussion went to economic issues, and it really doomed whatever chances. And I think, in all honesty, the odds were against McCain for a whole variety of reasons, mm-hmm. including just simply in our system of government, we typically think, well, it may be time for a change. And after 8 years of Republican control of the presidency, there was certainly a much stronger sentiment of, well, maybe it's time for a change than had been true in 2004, which was also a very close election in some ways. So,
right.
I think the odds were against McCain, but certainly once the economic issues came to the forefront, and there were also, you know, questions about McCain's behavior in the consultations in Congress that took place shortly thereafter that raised questions about him, and there were a lot of questions about Sarah Palin, given some of her gaffes in terms of interviews, and so it was. By the time that it was the third week in September, I think the die had been cast. It was clear Obama was going to win as long as he didn't really mess up terribly
right.
in the ensuing week.
When you take a look at the final vote, and you know, your specialty is survey research, how did the religious voting break down? Were there any significant swings or differences from previous elections among Catholics, evangelicals, the highly religious?
Yeah. Well, this would be the first take I would give on it, and that is, for the most part, even though there was a tremendous change in terms of how Republicans and Democrats saw the results of the elections, that, you know, the Democrats won big in 2008 and obviously lost in 2004, that the basic patterns in which religious groups voted did not change markedly. Probably the biggest change was among African Americans who always voted highly Democratic previously,
right?
But just went overwhelmingly. I mean, and according to survey data, about 18% of African Americans voted for Bush in 2004. Maybe 5% did voted for McCain in 2008. So you had a big shift among African Americans. Really, what changed was more the influx of minority voters to the polls in the wake of having our first nominee who was a minority candidate running for the office of the presidency. And so many Hispanics, it appears from our survey data at least, influx of Hispanics and an influx of African Americans to the polls is what really gave the margin of victory to Obama. There is an old political adage that elections are won at the margin, and
right.
You don't need to change everybody's votes. You just need to change the votes of a few, or you need to mobilize a few more voters to change the outcomes in different states. And I think that was largely the case in 2008. Now, there are a few differences. Our survey, our book is based upon a particular survey that we conducted.
Mm-hmm.
John Green at the University of Akron also conducts a similar survey with we have identical questions in our surveys. Not every question is identical, but many identical questions. We adopt a similar approaches. The one difference between John Green's survey, post-election survey, and ours relates to what we would call centrist mainline Protestants and centrist Roman Catholics. Our data suggests that mainline Protestants voted more Democratic overall than what John Green's data suggests. And our data suggests that perhaps Catholics voted somewhat more Republican than what his data suggests. But these are, I think, within margins of error, and so it's unclear. They're both groups vote approximately half Democratic and half Republican. So whether one is 52% for the Republican and 48% for the Democrat, or vice versa, they're close, but obviously who gets the majority votes may appear differently in the two surveys. So the real question is, did mainline Protestants vote Democratic for the first time, or did they remain marginally Republican in 2008? And then the same question could be raised about Roman Catholics.
Let's, with the 10 minutes or so that we have here, let's bring this up to the current election season. We have midterm elections coming up in when this airs will be about a month in early November. And do you see any religious factors at play here? Or do you think economic issues are going to be the main driving force? And I say this in light of what we started out at the beginning of the podcast, this issue of these surveys by Pew Forum and by Time Magazine that, well, Obama is a Muslim or perceived, and you have this mosque controversy in New York City. Is that going to make any difference, or are we talking this is going to be a bread-and-butter type of election?
Well, I think overall it's likely to be much more a bread-and-butter type of election than it is to be something that based upon more cultural issues, if we want to label it that way. But sometimes those cultural issues get infused with different understandings of economic approaches and so forth. So to what extent free enterprise and the Christian faith are linked together may vary from one person's mind to another. And certainly if you talk about less government, addressing government debt, fostering more individual enterprise, there are notions of sort of, historic understandings of the way in which the Christian faith may have come to apply to the operations of American government, which may link in the minds of some people, at least, that these kinds of economic issues are, in fact, related to their religious perspectives. So in that sense, I think it may be more underneath the discussion than an open aspect of the whole public debate, but it may be there subtly in some important way.
Mm-hmm. What about the Tea Party movement? I mean, many people have been talking quite a deal about this, you know, these folks rising up, and for the very first time they've been involved in politics and such, and it tends to be, you know, a more conservative movement than anything. I mean, it is religion, you know, from your vantage point, and I don't know if you've conducted any surveys on this or if there have been any surveys at all conducted on it, does there seem to be any religious influence that is making its way through the Tea Party movement here in terms of just the ideas or even possibly the mobilization?
Well, I've not done any surveys, and most of my comments will be based upon just personal observations. I can't necessarily assess it as a sort of a unified whole, but my first impression is that the Tea Party is quite diverse in terms of its composition. People are angry, but they're angry about many different things, and so it's their, I guess you could say their, maybe anger is not the right word, but their dissatisfaction is motivated by a whole host of different things, and the thing that unifies them is simply dissatisfaction with the present operation that's seems to be evident today. I will say I was on a family vacation and I was driving through portions of downstate Illinois a couple weeks ago, and I was quite surprised to see the number of Tea Party signs in some of the yards of different towns in which I went through. And that made me think, well, maybe there's a lot more organization to this than I had realized from where I sit here in Michigan, because I don't see quite as much of it here. But I do think that for some Tea Party members there are religious elements involved, but for the most part I think it's much more of a libertarian mm-hmm. kind of approach, which, if it is libertarian, which basically says we don't want government involved in, say, issues of morality and what is you know, permissible,
right.
then it starts to lose some of its religious component, because many religious people would say, yeah, we're okay with, you know, liberty with regard to economic matters, free enterprise, that kind of thing, but when it comes to morality, government may need to be involved a little bit more mm-hmm. than what, say, some of the Tea Partiers who are more libertarian would want.
You can definitely see that as a cross-cutting tension among the conservative side of the aisle, that you do have the libertarian folks on the economic side that also want to extend it to the social issues, just like get government out of everything. But then you have social conservatives that might agree on some of the economic issues, but they say, whoa, we need to regulate
right.
some things.
Exactly.
And that's a difficult thing for the GOP to juggle in that regard. Do you think that this Obama being a Muslim poll is going to have any traction, or perhaps the Ground Zero mosque controversy? Do you think that right now, when we're talking here in late August of 2010, that was the big topic mid-August here, but, you know, we're still a couple months away from the election. As we talk here, is this going to be a big issue?
I don't see it so much as an issue in the off-year elections. I see it as more an issue related to Obama and his re-election.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it may be that there are people who will try to make political hay of this during the campaign season itself. I just don't see it having much traction for whether the 3rd District congressional candidate here, who's a Democrat, takes a stand one way or the other on it. I don't think it's going to have that kind of impact. But I do think this is all related to how people perceive Obama and his presidency, and to what extent he has been as, openly religious as maybe he needs to be to address some of these issues. Although you could argue that he certainly has done a fair amount already, and why is it that the American people can't make correct perceptions of some of this.
Yeah. Well, it's just one of the things that I noticed. Everybody's talking about the Muslim part of the survey, but one of the things that I found interesting about the Pew Forum was the pretty big increase in the number of people who have no idea if Obama is a Muslim or not. And this goes back to our earlier discussion that, you know, people, when it comes to, you know, making choices on the national scene, are a little bit more skeptical of atheists. And if that ambiguity increases for Obama, that could be more of a problem than, say, any affiliation that he has with Islam or anything.
Right, right. And that, you know, that is, Obama has not chosen to join a church in Washington, D.C., or even to publicly attend church with any regular, well, I don't even know if he's attended church at all. I know that he's has contact with different ministers and clergy who serve as spiritual advisors, but to what extent he has publicly sort of been seen, photographed, you know, going in and out of church on a Sunday. But if you think back, certainly the Clintons were photographed in that fashion.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that George Bush was necessarily photographed that way. I can't recall, but there was less question about his religious faith. And so I think, you know, the Obamas are going to have to, or President Obama is going to have to try to address this in some different ways over the course of the next couple of years, or it could create a real political problem for him. And again, it isn't so much that everybody has to believe one way or the other, but to the extent that there are doubts and that affects people's votes, any shift, small shift, as we were talking about before, 2 or 3% can make a big difference in outcomes of elections.
Mm-hmm. Well, in closing here, I just want to talk a little bit about your own research. One of the things that I find very intriguing about what you do as a scholar is that you work with a wide variety of authors. The book that we've been talking about, The Disappearing God Gap, which we will link to our website here, is not only written by yourself, but we have other scholars as well as James Penning, Stephen Monsma, Kevin Dendulk, Brian Fraley, and Doug Koopman are all involved in here, and you have connections with a number of other folks as well. And at top of it, at the Henry Institute at Calvin College, you bring a lot of these folks together, not only seasoned scholars, but graduate students for training. And do you find that to be really beneficial in your own research? It just seems like a really great way of doing research.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both more enjoyable and it's more beneficial in terms of the outcome. Certainly there are challenges in working together. There are different styles. People have different ideas about what should be addressed or what should not be addressed. But, you know, once you sort of get together and say, well, this is what we want to do, and this is, I think, how we should try to go about organizing it, allowing each person to bring their particular skills to bear and having the insights of different scholars and discussions on some of these matters, I think enriches the whole enterprise. So I have always enjoyed working together. I think I have learned a lot. I think I'm a better scholar today because of having worked together with other scholars than I would have been had I just been working on my own.
Mm-hmm.
It does mean that, you know, there are particular challenges, and then there are questions of who contributes what and whether or not people have contributed equally and all that kind of thing. But I don't get too bogged down in that. I think as long as people make a good faith effort and we're in this together, we take the credit together and we go down together in some ways. But it is an enjoyable experience. I enjoy my work a whole lot more because of my relationships with other colleagues.
And tell us just in closing here about the graduate workshop series that you run here, because I know that some of our listeners to this program, not only lay listeners and some other scholars, but graduate students, and we've tossed out a few dissertation topic ideas as we've gone along here in the past hour. How can what happens during one of these graduate seminars, and how can graduate students get involved in this?
Sure. Over the past, 7 or 8 years, I have run a a graduate workshop along with John, with Jim Guth of Furman University and Lyman Kelstedt, who is emeritus at Wheaton College, and with whom I've done a lot of work with previously in terms of other scholarship. We do a week-long workshop on religion and American politics. And what we do is we look at different approaches to measuring religion. We look at different surveys and the kinds of religious questions they have. We look at the strengths and weaknesses of different kinds of approaches. I mean, if you think about, just think about evangelicals. Well, you could measure evangelicals and identify evangelicals by denominational affiliation. You could try to do it by religious beliefs. You could try to do it by religious identities. And so the question then arises, well, what do these different approaches assume about the nature of evangelicalism? To what extent is one approach more prone to certain kinds of findings than another approach? For example, identities are likely to be much more politicized. Someone who knows they're an evangelical would may behave differently than someone who is an evangelical by sort of affiliation but doesn't even recognize the term of what it means, and so forth. So we go through these different understandings of and measurement approaches and try to assess then what might be the best ways to approach something, and then in an ideal situation, and then try to say, okay, now here are some existing data files, and you're limited to the religious questions that other people have raised. What would be the best ways of trying to use these kinds of data to get the more precise or perhaps the more revealing kinds of results that you might be able to obtain given the limitations of the data themselves? And we typically have somewhere between 15 to 25 students. It partly depends upon how much money is available for our doing this. We do it on a competitive basis. We have political scientists, sociologists, people who are involved in religious studies on occasion. We've had people involved in public policy studies of a range of different disciplines, but primarily sociologists of religion and political scientists. Mm-hmm. And I tend to select people who are farther along in their graduate program over those who are just starting their graduate program. An argument can be made either way as to which one would be the best approach, but by selecting those who are farther along, we give younger scholars at least an additional opportunity if they're not selected to be selected later in the process.
Right.
And so it's a fun time, good networking for the graduate students. We get the enjoyment of meeting young scholars who are beginning their study of religion and hope to continue to encourage them in that endeavor and motivate them to continue in that particular pursuit.
Yeah, I know that one of my own students, Katie Stenger, has actually benefited quite a bit from that program in the past. And so we're more than happy to put a link up for any graduate students who are interested in knowing what the Henry Institute offers them through these various workshops, as well as data sets that you have up there and a number of research reports. So, Corin, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion today. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Tony. I've really appreciated the opportunity to talk with you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.